Hi, Sasha. How are you?
I'm well. This was one of the most powerful conversations I think we've had on this show that you are about to hear.
Yeah, it was harrowing, and it's you know, all credit to Scarlett. You know, I think he's a really a beautiful personality.
Yeah.
You know, when he said, you know, my whole childhood was medicalized, he was right. You know, it feels like doctors imposed a medicalized life on a young, sensitive boy.
Yeah. So Scarlett is going to share his story of childhood transition from the age of 12. His gender questions began to be kind of molded into a trans identity and a medicalization. And, you know, he describes prior to that having kind of a difficult childhood, having some autism traits or maybe a diagnosis, and being made to feel as though his femininity was pathological from a very young age, including his exuberance and some of his personality traits. And so he felt like there was something wrong. You know, we don't want to put words in Scarlett's mouth, but that's certainly something that you will probably pick up on in hearing this interview. And just off the top, we wanted to kind of share a couple of things that we had noticed, and then we'll just let Scarlett take it away. First of all, you know, as a child who was medicalized and transitioned, of course, Scarlett is Scarlett's legal name. And when we spoke before the recording, I asked Scarlett, how do you want us to deal with names and pronouns? And Scarlett said, I want you to just, what I said is that I try to be as organic as I can. And Scarlett said, yeah, generally, I just tell people use whatever makes you feel comfortable. And as you'll hear, in Scarlett's story, like, especially by the end of it, I started to really feel as though I'm just talking with this very lovely, sensitive young man who has soft traits and a lovely personality. And organically, I see Scarlett as a him. So we're using he, him pronouns during the conversation, and I'm very comfortable with that.
Yeah. And Scarlett did say he's comfortable with use whatever. And, you know, this is, you know, going out in Detrans Awareness Day, and the whole concept of detransition is complex, and Scarlett doesn't as such identify as a detransitioner, but he does say use whatever pronouns you want, and he falls in with the word androgyny. You know, this is where he kind of, that's what resonates with him. And honestly, I think one thing about Detrans Awareness Day is to bring some awareness to the complicated nature of life after transition. It's not just like transition is a misnomer, detransition is a misnomer. You don't transition to somebody else. You don't transition to the opposite sex. Equally, you don't detransition from your transition. They're both They're both kind of, you know, wrongly titled and could lead people to really feel, I think a lot of people start the detransition process and then think that's not really what I wanted. I'm not sure what I wanted. Scarlett doesn't seem to have started a detransition process. It's more along the lines of, I'm now androgynous. An awful lot of medicalizing happened to me when I was very young. So informed consent wasn't in the picture. You know, Scarlett received estrogen at 13. So cross-sex hormones, i.e., you know, you know, body development such as breasts and hips at such a young age. And yet there's a kind of a realization of maybe this wasn't appropriate for me. Would I be right in saying that?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, and, you know, Scarlett talks towards the end of our conversation just about how he understands where he's at now and that he just really wants to let nature and his body do its thing, basically, and kind of has come off hormones. Another thing we just thought was really powerful was that Scarlett's story is an embodiment of what happens in gender affirming care, particularly in light of the recently released WPATH files, which demonstrate clearly that WPATH clinicians know that there are very dangerous medical complications that come from early intervention and these surgeries and hormones, and deliberately withhold that information from patients and sometimes mislead patients. And so Scarlett's story is such a difficult but perfect example of this, because as you'll hear along the way, Scarlett's real needs were never really met or addressed. And to this day, Scarlett describes the weirdness with which doctors interact with him and don't really know how to see him as a whole person and treat him with both truth and honesty and also compassion. Like, it's really complicated. So in light of the WPATH files coming out, we just think it's really instructive to listen to Scarlett tell his story.
And one other aspect, there's so many parts of this. I agree with you. This is one of the most important interviews I think we've done. And one undertone to Scarlett's story was the, you know, inappropriate sexualization of a child that kind of is happening online and isn't really been lifted, I think, enough. I don't think people talk about grooming and stuff, but it's become a word of abuse. Mm-hmm. And I don't think people really understand actually what's going on. The amount of times Scarlett said, you know, it was icky and, you know, I felt icky. He learned to hate himself because of some sort of sexualized identity that was put upon him, as well as living in a completely homophobic community. The combination seemed to be incredibly damaging to his psyche. But I think then, you know, like kind of being asked to walk through a fetish shop with his parent. Do you remember that when he was
this was a recommendation from one of the treatment providers. So as you'll hear, in addition to this kind of online kind of inappropriate grooming by older men that Scarlett experienced in the comfort of their, you know, his own home, once he got into the treatment pathway of gender affirming care, he was continually bombarded with questions and treatment recommendations that sexualized him.
There you go. Yeah.
So it's just such a tragic and enraging to think that this kid was already like his sexuality was being challenged and questioned and like perverted by other people, like every step of the way. And we really hope that moving forward, Scarlett is able to develop like a healthier, more self-compassionate relationship with his sexuality and discover it for himself on his own terms and in a way that is full of love and care. You know, like I just, throughout the whole interview, I just wished I could reach out and hug Scarlett. Oh. Like, it was really powerful, and it was, I just felt very tenderly towards Scarlett. And so, I don't know. I think that's enough of an intro. We'll just let listeners enjoy our conversation with Scarlett.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Stella O'Malley, a psychotherapist in Ireland.
And I'm Sasha Ayad, an adolescent therapist in the United States.
And this is Gender, A Wider Lens, a podcast dedicated to the shifting concepts around gender in our contemporary culture.
Through in-depth interviews, personal stories, and psychological exploration, we seek to open up the discourse around this hot-button issue.
Join us as we look at gender from a wider lens.
Hi, Stella, and welcome to the show, Scarlett.
Hi, how is everybody?
Good. I remember we met you some time ago, and both me and Sasha, we were very moved by you. You know, you stayed in our minds. It was a harrowing story you told us, and you're very extraordinarily impressive in the face of such a devastating story. So I'm really glad you decided to share it on the podcast, because I think it's an important story that people need to hear.
Well, thank you. It's just something, I mean, it's something that's kind of bled into every aspect of my life. And it's just really important that I just share what I've gone through, because like, as I've gotten older over these past couple of years, just in retrospect, a lot of the things I went through, I don't feel like were right in regards to like the therapeutic procedures and the medical procedures that I had gone through. There wasn't really a lot of honesty involved. And I just feel like it's really important to share that, considering how common these procedures are becoming, because when I first started, it wasn't very common at all. But now I'm kind of seeing it pop up everywhere. So I think it's just important to share my story.
In understanding what you have been through and all of these kind of medical harms that you face, why don't we start pretty early in your life? Can you just tell us a little bit about what kind of kid you were as a child, and then like how did you end up seeking help for gender issues in the first place?
So when I was really little, I was a pretty troubled child, honestly. I've always struggled with like pretty intense anxiety, and like depression issues. I had an early diagnosis for high functioning autism for Asperger's syndrome. But unfortunately, as a result of that, because I was pretty gender nonconforming already, I knew I liked boys from a very young age. I've pretty much been playing kiss and tag with boys since like preschool. It was just like a pretty normal thing to me. But I came from a very small town. We went to a fundamentalist Christian church. Not necessarily because my mom grew up Christian, but was just like seeking some kind of spirituality, and that's just what was there at the time. So I was surrounded by a lot of pretty ableist and homophobic ideas. Like a lot of my gender nonconformity was blamed on my autism, and I was treated very, very differently. Like I wasn't allowed in like normal classes in school, so I didn't get to do any classes with my friends. Like whenever kids would watch movies, I was not allowed in the classroom. I was just kind of always set aside and kind of ridiculed for being different, and for like just how I was. And I was very emotional most of my childhood, so obviously all of this would make me cry a lot, which then got like I got punished a lot in school, which led to my mom homeschooling me on and off growing up, due to that.
And can I ask, what age are you now? And do you remember roughly what age you were diagnosed with autism?
I think I was like 4 or 5. I was very young. Some of my first memories were actually being in doctor's offices for autism, like counselor's offices. I had some like counselor aides that would like represent me at school and stuff and try to like fight for my like treatment or whatever.
Can I also ask, because you said something that I think we could easily gloss over, but I don't want to miss. Your gender nonconformity was being attributed to your autism by, seems like, the school, the adults in your life, the doctors. That feels huge. Can you say a little more about that?
So during that time, you could still like have like a diagnosis for effeminate affect under like a disability. They considered it like a mental confusion. So like they said, because when you're autistic, you're so dualistic and black and white in your thinking that you can get confused and basically misunderstand like who you're supposed to be drawn to or like what you're supposed to wear, and in my case like who my friends were supposed to be, because I had a lot of female friends. I just kind of like I had a posse. I just kind of like rolled in that group, you know what I mean? And I don't know, they just saw it as like a weird like mental phenomenon. Like I was confused and I just wasn't smart enough to know that I was supposed to like football and women and stuff at 4 or 5 years old. So, yeah.
So you're really ostracized for your gender nonconformity in a lot of ways.
Yeah, even at home in my family, because like growing up, like, because like some of my family members would have shows like Family Guy and stuff streaming, and whenever there'd be like a gay episode, they would like have to change it. Because it made them uncomfortable. Like a lot of that fragile masculinity was very common when where I grew up. Even like among my siblings, like I love my brother, but there was a lot of like mocking around me being gay growing up because everyone kind of like guessed it, but no one really like wanted to say it because I could have been autistic and just been confused, but like I might grow up and be gay. Like it was kind of an unspoken thing looming in the background, like an elephant in the room, I guess.
Yeah.
So yeah.
So meanwhile, you're dealing with all of this kind of rejection for parts of you that felt very natural. And you also were, of course, lonely and crying a lot and dealing with anxiety. And you described yourself as a troubled kid.
Yeah, with like all of this, I guess you could call it rejection, or just with all of this prejudice that was around me, it kind of led me to be very like inwardly driven growing up. So I spent a lot of time like in my own mind, kind of like daydreaming. I liked to draw a lot when I was a kid. I would spend a lot of time in the woods, or now I spend a lot of time in my garden. Like I have you guys balance on an orchid right now because I didn't have anything to set my computer on. And I don't know, just I struggled a lot with feeling unwanted, like I was just like a burden to people. And I still struggle with that today. Like it's just something that I just start to feel like it's ingrained. I don't know. Yeah, I forgot where I was going with that. You guys are gonna have to direct me somewhat because this is,
Yeah, so
it's since it's my whole life, I get so convoluted.
of course.
So if I get lost, feel free to interrupt me and be like, "Hey, get back on track."
No problem. Don't worry.
Where basically a pretty hostile environment, which was not letting you watch the movies in class because they had you as this troubled kid. There was certainly homophobia rampant, as far as I can gather, both at home and in school. And you were diagnosed, and it was kind of hanging over you. Maybe this is all autism. That seemed to be the vibe. And carry on from there. Yeah.
A lot of quirks about my personality, or even if I would just so show like a genuine interest in anything growing up, it would be blamed on like an autistic obsession. Which was pretty hard to deal with. It was like my whole childhood was medicalized almost, because like I could never just be interested in something like gardening, for example, or a hobby at school, or anything like that. Because it was always some crazy obsession or something I had to be medicated for. And it put a lot of stress on like the relationship between me and my mom because she was kind of the only one that was really like fighting for me. So a lot of the time she was having to be like this wall between me and like the rest of the world that was kind of coming at me with all of this prejudice, basically.
How was mom fighting for you? Tell us a little bit more. Like, it must have been hard position for her to be in too.
So since I was so young, I just remember her being on the phone a lot with doctors, kind of like arguing about like she would ask them like, "Well, what are you giving her? Like, what are you trying to medicate her for? Can you give me a reason? Well, what about the side effects to these things?" She would always kind of do her research about stuff and avoided me going on quite a few things like Adderall or Ritalin, things that I would have never needed in the long run, but doctors were pretty insistent on me having at that time. Because they didn't really want to, like, when I would go to therapy for my anxiety or my depressive issues or my autism, my therapist never really like delve into it. They just kind of blamed everything on me having a neurological or a neurodevelopmental issue. And they would just kind of treat me like I just kind of didn't know myself or what was going on. Kind of just tell me what they thought, and that was just what I was supposed to follow. So my mom would kind of step in between that a lot and kind of keep these people away from me. It really made me clingy to her growing up, honestly, because I felt like she was kind of the only one that was like fighting for me out there. Because even my own family would like totally pretend like they didn't even know me. Whenever a doctor would have a new diagnosis for me, they would just be like totally down with it. Despite prior knowledge, they just don't, I
Yeah.
guess, recall it.
So you said something really interesting, and I want to just loop this into our understanding. You said mom would be on the phone saying, "What are you diagnosing her with?" And of course, we're going to hear a lot about your story, your social and medical transition. But at one point, I mean, well, I guess early in your life, you were seen as, recognized as, treated as a boy. And then something shifted where you started to kind of play with the concept of gender identity. So can you tell us a little bit about how that transition, for lack of a better term, happened between like Scarlett as a little boy to Scarlett as a trans-identified kid?
So growing up, like I said, I was always kind of pretty effeminate. I like had female friends. I was pretty typical of that group. I liked playing dress up. I was pretty typical like feminine boy. I had some masculine hobbies. Like I liked horror movies because my granny did, and I liked to climb trees and stuff like that. But I was pretty like set on like the neighborhood boys and like trying to feel pretty, I guess. And I guess the older I got and the closer I got to puberty, I'd started, because like around that time, Omegle and like Kick and all of those were like big online. So obviously, being homeschooled on and off, most of my friends were online friends. And I was just discovering through that around that time that I was probably gay, like discover confirming for myself that I was probably gay because I was talking to like some older guys online. And I guess over time, I just started to feel pretty like, I don't know, just like kind of grossed out with the like just how I was developing and the idea of like developing into like a young boy, I guess, because these guys were like creeps. So they were like kind of grooming me. I didn't know that word at the time, but it just kind of gave me a heebie-jeebie feeling. And just as I was maturing and starting puberty, it just I really got uncomfortable in my body. Like it was like I felt gross. I felt like a troglodyte. I felt like I couldn't go out in public. I was like constantly checking myself in the mirror, and nothing I did was ever accurate. So I would just like hide myself in my room and just not leave for days. I ended up quitting school for quite a few years until up until high school. This was around like fifth, sixth grade. I ended up leaving school because I just couldn't deal with people observing me. It was just too much for me.
Could I ask a little bit about the grooming? Because I often think it's kind of understated and swept under the rug a little bit, that it seems to me that there's quite a lot of boys, especially boys, I'm not sure, but who do seem to be targeted by very, very abusive older men who seem to really wreck the heads of these kids.
On some of those like chat sites like Kick, because it's like a non-traceable site, I was exposed to a lot of really messed up individuals. And back then, like, because it was like communicating through a screen, I didn't really associate like danger with it. But now in retrospect, I'm like, I was probably talking to some very dangerous people. Because they just kind of present themselves, like they can kind of tell by the way you make your profile or the way you state yourself in your like bio that you're different or whatever. And I think me being effeminate and having kind of like, very elaborately decorated profiles and stuff like that, I just kind of drew those individuals in. You know what I
And
mean?
did they seek or did they propel this idea that you should transition?
No, not necessarily in my case. When I did eventually start transitioning, it was, I mean, definitely like more people were trying to talk to me online after that. But it wasn't like them motivating me to transition. I just kind of felt gross with like the idea of them perceiving me as like a young boy or like a what was the word they like a twink almost at that age. And it just made me feel icky.
They were sexualizing you. Yeah, being sexualized when you're just a child. And I mean, you're clearly like, you're figuring out that you like guys and you like men, but like they are taking things to a direction that you're just like, whoa, this is
And it was almost like, because I already had this like idea that being gay was like this like unspeakable thing, right? From the church and from just like the attitudes of the town that I came from. So this just kind of played into that like idea of like homosexuality is like not always, but like a lot of the
Dirty.
times probably kind of a messed up power dynamic-y thing, because that was all I was like exposed to at that time. This was like shortly after gay marriage was like being legalized, but it was still like a controversial thing in the United States, and it was, a whole thing at that time. So it just kind of played into my idea of a negative attitude towards homosexuality, basically, and towards myself because of that. Like, I don't want to grow up and be that, or I don't want to grow up and have to deal with people like that. And then they'll only like, be into you for a time and you age out of that. And I felt so gross thinking like that might be my life.
Yeah, and this is just so important because we say internalized homophobia. We throw that word around like very flippantly, but this is actually what it looks like. It's very delicate. It's very much like an interplay between like the creepy people who are talking to you and how they're talking to you and the kind of ideas you already have about what, the gay lifestyle, quote unquote, means. So this is all pretty subtle. And so I'm so glad that you're raising that. And I'm really sorry that you went through that as a kid, like when you were just already struggling. I'm so sorry. And I'm just grateful that you're sharing this part of your story. So after these kinds of interactions, you start to really feel uncomfortable with the idea of growing up to become a young man or a boy, a twink, or whatever those ideas were.
Yeah, absolutely. I just felt icky with the idea of that. And I had also had some like body image issues like prior to this, but they were very minor as a kid. Like, I would feel like my nose was too big, 'cause like in my family we have like a very like, not like a crooked nose, but like a very like, it's shaped almost like a beak. And I just feel like, I don't know, that always bothered me even as a young child. But it's like I hyper focused on those things. Probably one of the only things in my life that I can say I truly had a hyper focus, like obsession on. I just like ruminated on all of the flaws in my appearance. And it just more and more started like popping up in my awareness, because I was starting to come upon puberty around like 11, 12, 11-ish, 12. And it just led me to isolate myself so much more, because I felt so ungodly repulsive. Like, I just felt like I couldn't leave the house. I didn't feel like I really had like a true future for me. I felt like I was aging out. It was a lot. And around that time, I like obviously I had heard of like Jazz Jennings and like Gigi Gorgeous and people like that, because I would watch like all the makeup reviews and stuff like that. And the idea of being able to avoid that was very attractive to me, because I was like, oh, it'll like keep me from like growing a beard or getting like super tall or like my face. Like, I was really bothered by like my brow bone at the time, because I feel like if it grew out anymore, I felt like I would look like a caveman. And that like really, really bothered, like it sounds stupid now saying it, but at the time that was like catastrophic to me. I felt like I would have no chance at like a livable life if that happened. Sounds really dramatic
Can
now,
I
but
point out that it is dramatic, but it's also very common for teenagers. I remember being like that, and I think the intensity and madness and massiveness of my thoughts about kind of fairly random things like that, that you look back thinking, what sort of fever was over me? I think we forget it, and I'm glad you brought it up because I do think it's actually quite common. And it's huge for those kids at the time because they're young and everything is just swirling, and it's almost an animalistic kind of existence where you're just like,
yeah.
It's extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah, it was pretty animalistic, like how much I ruminated on those things. Because it was like that was like my whole world. It was just trying to fix my flaws and trying to avoid my flaws. It was like I was avoiding, like, it was literally, it felt like I was dealing with like a severe illness, but the illness was just like my own natural body development. It was pretty, I don't even know like what word I could apply to it. Pretty like dividing, because it felt like a real like battle between like mind and matter. It got that bad at a certain point. I just felt like I had no feasible way to live a life otherwise. Which eventually led me into like seeking out treatments. Like I was the one that found out about U of M services, not my mom. I was the one that started emailing and seeking that out at, I believe I just turned 13, or I was turning 13.
And do you remember when you first thought maybe I should be a girl, or do you, was it Jazz Jennings, or what, where did it come
So
from?
I can't really pinpoint a fixed point when I had like the realization of like, oh my gosh, I want to live as a girl. It was just like I was trying to avoid my like development into a man, I guess. And this was just the way to do that with medicine, or so I thought. That's what I was reading. So I just reached out because it piqued my interest, if that makes sense.
We want to take a moment to thank our sponsors, GenSpect and Therapy First. GenSpect is an international organization committed to fostering a healthy approach to sex and gender. The team and members of GenSpect strive to promote high-quality, evidence-based care for gender nonconforming individuals. GenSpect is pleased to offer a non-medicalized approach to gender with their recently published Gender Framework, and they continue to hold conferences around the world. Visit genspect.org to learn more.
Therapy First is a non-profit worldwide professional association of mental health providers who view psychotherapy as the appropriate first-line treatment for gender dysphoria. Therapy First supports psychotherapists working with gender dysphoric youth and young adults and offers public education on mental health and psychotherapy. Visit therapyfirst.org to learn more.
Now back to the show.
Okay, and so you start researching these services, and tell us what happens at that point.
So in my research, I didn't really find anything in regards to like side effects and stuff. Because like obviously on like the hospital websites at the time, there were like links to like transgender forms and stuff. So I would kind of like read through there to like read other people's experiences and oh, excuse me, and stuff like that. And I didn't really see anything talking about downsides at all. Well, I read one story about a sex reassignment surgery that went bad. But that was like pretty much it. Like it was just like a freak incident and you never really heard about it. And at that time, there weren't really many like what you could call like I guess like autogynephilic people out there. I didn't really run into many of those in the beginning. It was mostly people that like me were like little gay boys, and it was just not a friendly environment, and they just transitioned and tried to live their lives like that, and they didn't really mention anything about downsides, so I felt like it was pretty safe.
Can you give us approximately what year was this?
2014, 2015. So
Okay,
I was 12 going on 13 when I first started researching.
so you were born, if I'm right, maybe 2002, maybe 2 years later than Jazz Jennings or something.
Yes, I was born in 2002, the end of 2002, like one of the last months.
So you're reading online accounts from other gay males who are transitioning or thinking of transitioning or have started transitioning. And what are people talking about? I guess, like, clearly you're sitting here with us. So whatever they said must have, I guess, confirmed for you that you wanted to pursue this. So, like, what were some of the positive things they were describing? Because you said they didn't talk about a lot of negative side effects except for like one story.
So the idea was is that like once you start like passing, you could just like live a normal life without really having to like adjust like who you're attracted to, because like pretend like being gay and like just not being with people was very common at that time. So it was like a way to like just live a normal life and like just disappear into society, marry a man, not have to worry about, people having any sort of discriminatory ideas about you and your neighborhood and things like that. It was a way to kind of like fly under the radar, basically, was the thought. And that was kind of like what they discussed most of the time is like, oh, I met my husband and we're happy, 20 years married, life is great, never hear about any of the, people never look at us weird type of stuff. Like just living a normal life. That was pretty much all I ever wanted was to be loved and live a normal life.
So then you at some point must have told mom, or what? What happens next?
Yeah, so at that point, my mom was traveling for work. So I had called her one day, and because I had decided I wanted to roll with this, I felt like there was no other option. And I just called her and I told her, hey, I think I'm transgender. That was just the word that I knew to use. And I really need to take steps to get treatment for it. At that point, I was more looking for like exploratory therapy to kind of like figure out, because at that point, gatekeeping was still a thing for these medications. So you still had to go through a therapist. So I was kind of hoping to just see like a therapist that specialized in this so I can kind of figure out if this is going to be the right path for me, was my thought. And she thought, okay, explore, you've always been non-conforming, so maybe exploratory therapy will be good for you, and I started growing out my hair, and dressing more like how I wanted to dress. I was already dressing pretty androgynously, but I was just like kind of, I had full liberty to express myself at that point. And obviously I felt great with that. So that was just what we were rolling with.
But you weren't necessarily using the word exploratory yourselves, were you, or were you?
Not at that time, because we didn't really have the vocabulary for that. I was young and my mom came from a very small town where there isn't really a lot of gay people. Most of them would like move to the city and, might come back to visit their families, but it wasn't super common in our town.
Well, and
So
to be fair to you guys, it wasn't even a word. Like,
no,
nobody was
yeah.
using the word exploratory therapy. There was kind of the old model, which is transsexuals will come to therapy, they'll have gender identity disorder or gender dysphoria, and then they'll do this long, long, long assessment, figure out what's going on, and then,
And
you
that
know.
was kind of what I was hoping for, was like in this assessment, they'll basically be able to figure out like if this is going to be a right path for me, or I can determine if it's not, and I can just get treatment with whatever the heck else I was dealing with. Because I was definitely dealing with some kind of body image issues. It was just very prominent, and I just needed help for it. And that's what I was looking for.
And so what happened? You told your mother in that phone call you think you might be transgender. How did she respond? And when did the doctors and the intervention, how did that come about?
Well, she cried because I was crying, but it wasn't like, I don't think it was like crying, like a devastated crying. I think it was crying like, well, I don't know what this means, but also, why are you crying kind of thing. And I don't know, we just talked about it, and I told her I like boys in that phone call too, which was like probably the main reason why I was crying, because I had all this built up
Totally.
stress about it. I was like sweating profusely before this call. I was like shaking on the phone call. My voice was all shaky. It was a whole thing. So she responded well. She was totally okay with me doing like a social transition. She was like, I don't care what you wear. Of course, you can grow your hair out. And, if you want to wear makeup more like openly or regularly and not just be playing with my makeup anymore, we can buy your own makeup. That's not a big deal. She was pretty liberal about, surprisingly liberal about it. She was just like, you're my kid and I love you no matter what. And we set up an appointment with a gender therapist through the hospital. And it was just like during my social transition to life was pretty normal up until I went to that therapy appointment. We would sometimes email with the therapist in between, just like leading up to the appointment, just kind of like confirming everything and all of that. It was pretty professional at that point. And life was just normal. Other than my, like, I still had all my body image issues, but our day to day didn't really change that much until I went in for that first appointment. And it was like a 30, 40 minute assessment for them to make a diagnosis. And then the story gets like pretty typical in regards to this stuff where it's like, would you rather have like a dead son or a living daughter type of stuff. I kind of felt like the therapist was twisting my words too when I was in there, because I'd be telling her about like, being non-conforming and kind of like just wanting to grow my hair out and whatever. And she would almost want to like twist my words to make it sound like I was like a female soul trapped in a male body kind of stuff. Like she tried to make it sound like suicidal thoughts I'd had in the past were like my inner woman raging at not being allowed to be a male. And I was like, well, that's really weird. At that point, I think I'd even told her that I think she was confusing that like gender stuff with something else, because I've always been a gentle kid. Like even like in school, when teachers would want me to defend myself, I would cry and like run away. I'm just not like a violent person like that. And she they were like twisting everything I'd ever dealt with into like being this like inner female essence that like wanted out and like wanted to express itself. And I was like, well, okay, can I get my medicine that I thought I needed? You know what I mean? Does that make sense?
I don't want to take us too far off the tangent because this timeline is really important, but it's really interesting. I don't remember if I was talking to you or maybe it was some other conversation, but I think you said when you started to meet males with gender dysphoria who were autogynephilic, it started to make a lot of sense to you why the therapists like took this certain angle. And I really hope I'm not like misremembering that because
No, that
they
was
say
definitely
there's
me
a female
because.
essence in you. That's actually the autogynephilic experience. That's not the gay man who transitions experience.
Yes, and I think I even told her that I thought she was confused. I told her she was confused on something because she was like trying to ask me like how I feel when I wear girls' clothes. Like, does it make me get fuzzy feelings and stuff like that? Do I feel affirmed in them? And I'm like, what? Like, because I've always just worn whatever I wanted to wear, like I'm wearing a blouse right now and like male sweatpants, like because they're comfy. It doesn't, they're clothes, it just never, that was never a thing for me. And I thought it was really weird. It made me feel almost like those guys online were making me feel. It was that same heebie-jeebie feeling with some of the questions that she was asking me in regards to like how I like the feelings and sensations I get when I like am acting feminine. I was like, that's weird. It was really weird.
So you could sense that there was a sexual undertone to what she was implying. And that's why you got the heebie. You're 12 or 13, and you're like, what? So that's really important here.
Yeah, it was really uncomfortable. And they just kind of like laughed it off and like brushed it on by. And we just like kind of left that part of the conversation behind. And we're talking more about like, the homophobia and stuff like that. And she was like, well, yeah, you sound like you were just a girl being forced to live as a boy this whole time. So like, we can definitely like, there's been so many trans women that have just grown up and gotten married and adopted families and live a happy, normal life. So we can totally help you do that. And I was like, awesome. And that was in like 30, 40 minutes. And I remember I was the first appointment and I came out and then she called my mom in there. And after like 15 minutes, I just hear my mom like sobbing. I didn't know what she had told her at that time. I guess she had told her that I was like going to kill myself and this is the only option. And like, yeah, this is somewhat experimental, but at the same time, they've also been doing this for decades and it's completely safe. But like, yeah, you have a daughter that you've been suppressing her entire life. So you better fix that, basically.
And
my poor mom was like just devastated. She was devastated for a couple of days, actually. Whatever this therapist had told her, like, definitely turned her off to like whatever I was doing in that moment of time. Like, she eventually got over it and was like, well, you're just my kid and I love you again. But for a while there, she like was pretty quiet and just like kind of emotional from whatever they had told her. And I didn't quite like know what was said at that time. It wasn't until years later that I had asked her, because I was starting to hear about ROGD stories and stuff like that. And I was like, you know, what did they tell you that day? And she was like, well, you know, that you were going to kill yourself and I was going to have a living son or a dead son or a living daughter and stuff like that. And I was like, oh my God. Like, I've had suicidal tendencies in the past, but not like to the degree that they were like pushing it to. Like, I felt rejected and I was like, oh no, nobody wants me. But then like, you know, my mom was like, oh, but like I do. And I was like, oh, okay. You know, it wasn't like, you know, this like huge thing. Like, I wasn't going to just do it no matter what. Like, they were making it sound like, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And you weren't saying, oh, let me transition. I can't breathe. I can't live. You were by the sounds of it, you were more like, I really don't want to be gay.
Yeah. Well, that was it at first. Eventually, after I was on estrogen and stuff like that, my testosterone kicked up, because that's what happens when you first start estrogen, is your testosterone shoots through the roof because your body's like trying to get you back on track, basically.
Could you discuss before you go there just how you got onto estrogen? Because that's a big
moment. After that appointment with the gender therapist, she set me up with an appointment at a pretty big hospital. And I met an endocrinologist there. Actually, the one that like oversees that whole like department or whatever, like that whole field there. And we talked with him for like, I don't even remember how long it's been. We just went in there for like an appointment to like meet him and stuff. And he went over like the stages of like fetal development with me to be like, you know, we're all genderless originally, and it's not until testosterone enters the womb. And they were kind of painting it like I was intersex, basically. Like that testosterone came into the womb after my brain developed feminine, and then that's what made me male. So that's how you can have a female brain, a male body. And it was this whole thing. And I was like, you know, okay, that makes sense, I guess, you know, whatever.
You're just a kid and this is a doctor. I mean, yeah, it makes sense if your doctor's telling you that, but I mean, we know that's not true. That's not how it
works. And that's what I read online at the time. So I was like, you know, okay, that's what Google says. So
and you're about 13,
matches
14.
I was 13 at this point. I had just turned 13 at this point.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So, that happened. And after that appointment, I was starting on spironolactone for 6 weeks. And I remember the second day I was staying with my grandma and I fainted because it was causing like such severe like hot flashes. Because he had me on a dose. I was on like 250 milligrams or something crazy. It was a lot. I was pretty small at that point. I was like 5'5", 5'6", and like 100 pounds maybe.
And is this a puberty blocker you were on?
So spironolactone is kind of like a puberty blocker, but not quite as strong. It's an anti-androgen. So it's like, it's the most common testosterone inhibitor that they have trans women on, pardon me. And basically what it does is it's like a diuretic. So it's supposed to like flush out your excess testosterone by like keeping it from binding to your testosterone receptors in your cells.
Yeah.
So it kind of just flushes it, keeps your body from absorbing it, and then flushes the excess out.
And it immediately gave you a difficult impact immediately.
After a couple of days, yeah, I fainted because I was on way too high of a dose for my my weight, because I've always been pretty underweight, not for any like reason. I just like eat like a bird. And yeah, it just, it made me faint. It was way too much. So they halved my dose. And I was much better after that. And after those 6 weeks, I was then put on estrogen. I think we started at 2 milligrams and my testosterone had shot through the roof because they were trying to suppress it. And that's just like what a young male body does when it like feels threatened. And that made me like, I was developing a little bit quicker at that point. So I was like starting to get like peach fuzz on my chest and stuff. And I was like, that was like apocalyptic. And at that point I had felt like, you know, oh my God, I can't breathe. I like have to transition because my body is changing so fast.
Oh my God.
I just felt like, I literally felt like my body was like warping into it. It felt unnatural. You know what I mean? It was really bad. And so they jacked up my estrogen dosage, it was 4 or 6 milligrams at that point. I eventually ended up on 6 milligrams and just kind of stayed that way until I eventually went off. And as like my testosterone went down and I stopped really developing, you know, as quickly, like, I don't know. It felt like I had a moment to breathe for a second because I didn't have to worry about my body to continuously keep changing. I was just kind of paused and like where I was at for a minute. And some of my features started to get softer, like around my face and stuff like that. And I was like, you know, okay, like fine. This is much more manageable for me mentally at that point in time. And I was, you know, I had regular appointments with my endocrinologist, and I would ask him at these appointments, like, you know, how is this going to impact me, like, long-term? How is this going to impact, like, my sexual development? That was a huge concern of mine. And he told me that it's not really going to impact it. Like, I'm going to develop, like, another woman, basically. And I was like, but how? And he was like, it's not going to make you like dysfunctional or anything basically, but I'll just function like a feminized male and I won't have to like, I basically don't worry about it. And he would kind of act like these questions were super inappropriate as well and make me really uncomfortable asking them. Usually they would have my mom leave the room for these appointments as well, because we were going to be discussing topics like that. So they would just make us both feel really uncomfortable, like we were subjecting them to like some awful interrogation. When, you know, I needed to know this stuff, because these drugs do affect your sexual development. Even as an adult, they affect your sexual function. So like as a kid, like going through puberty, I needed to know how that would affect my physical development. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Can I ask, because I was just going to ask you if mom would have been in the room for those meetings. And so you shared that they usually split you guys up.
Yeah. So she was in the room a lot in the beginning. But eventually they kind of like split us up because they were worried about like if I had an accepting home, because she would always have questions on the medication basically. And they would act like her questions were inappropriate and then kind of like shimmied her out and were like, well, are you being abused? Is this an accepting home? You know, I should also stare. I should also share that I was a ward of the state at that point because my father's not present in my life. So the state basically had partial custody of me. So it was kind of like, you know, if there is ever a problem, we can always step in kind of thing. And at the time I was like, you know, oh, that's like really cool. But like, no, thank you. I'm good, but thanks. It wasn't until like these past couple of years that I'm like, oh, that's a pretty messed up thing to say to a 13, 14 year old who's like, you know, struggling this bad, you know?
There was something you said that it just rings a bell, that kind of often when people question the sexual functioning, they're shamed. Myself, Sasha, any of us, we're shamed as if we're the ones who are weird for wanting to know just fairly basic information about things, rather than it should be a non-shaming, very informed kind of scenario for both you and your mother. And she should have been as informed as you, because you were only 13. But also, you know, the shaming of you would have been incredibly powerful at your age. It would have been very silencing.
Well, it was not only powerful because of my age, but I also had all of this conditioning of like from my past childhood experiences of like kind of being shamed into not talking or been like, oh, you're just misunderstanding, just, look kind of like let the adults play a little bit was the mindset that kind of developed. Like it started out led by me, but then eventually it kind of felt like the reins were kind of not taken, but like definitely being like pushed along by, the doctors and stuff. I was also a part of studies, or so I thought. I w was informed I was going to be a part of like studies for the long-term side effects of this stuff. And I end like they just kind of like, stopped including me when I had started like showing like more interest in like how this would impact me. Like basically when I start asking questions, I stop getting included in these studies and stuff like that.
I want to just point something out because you've described yourself as kind of a shy kid who has a hard time speaking up for yourself and advocating for yourself. But I have to say, it's super impressive to think about you at 13 with all the crap you'd been through, asking your doctor persistently these questions to the point where they kicked you out of a study. Like, you are actually a very strong and impressive person.
Well, I do appreciate that and thank you. I will give it to my doctor that he did have a very open personality at least. So I did feel at first, before there was any kind of shaming, I did feel safe asking those questions at first because I felt like, he was just very friendly, or so it seemed. So I was very gobstruck when it was kind of like an uncomfortable thing and they didn't really want to answer it. And then I stopped getting the emails for the surveys and stuff. And I was like, this is very, not right. It kind of played into my feelings of rejection from the past too, a little bit. Cause I was like, this just felt shitty all around, basically. Cause I wasn't getting my questions answered. And around this time, they had put me on a GnRH inhibitor. That's a Lupron blocker that they implant in your arm. I have the scars right here. I don't know if you can see them.
But this is a
But
puberty blocker.
yeah, it's like a little device. It's like that long, and they put it in your arm, and it just like slow releases horm like not hormones or it maybe
Hormone
it's a hormone.
blockers.
It was. I don't remember if it was Hysterelin or Lupron. I think Hysterelin is the blocker version or the implant version. And that's the one I had. And they put that in because I didn't want to be on the Spiro long term because it's really bad for your kidneys in the long run because of how much it makes you pee. And I was starting to have issues in regards to like incontinence, basically. I would just like drip, 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 drip. And it was becoming like a problem for me. I was like, a certain point is like normal. Like a lot of people don't really talk about it, but it's very common at a certain level. But at a certain point, it gets to where it's like affecting your life and you kind of like got to do something about it. So I didn't want to stay on Spiro. And this was the alternative. And they told me that there's no real side effects to it. It'll just, suppress my, basically, it'll affect my pituitary gland. So, like, your pituitary gland releases hormones that tell whatever gonads you have, whether they're ovaries or whatever, to release its hormones. And what the puberty blocker does is it just goes directly to the source in your brain and it just switches that off. So your body isn't producing like follicle stimulating hormone to stimulate hair follicles. It's not producing whatever hormone it is that tells your body to produce its sex hormones. It just switches that off.
And it also
And
impacts the development of your genitals themselves.
yeah, it does. I was told that that was completely reversible. I was told that all of the side effects of that would be completely reversible, and that the only real side effect would be that I would just stop growing in certain respects. And I might get hot flashes at first, but those should go away. They never quite did go away. I still even get hot flashes now because I feel like my hormones are all up and down still. But that's jumping ahead again. After I got the implant, I started having hot flashes really, really bad. And I was homeschooled at this point. The doctor discouraged me going to school because they were worried I would get bullied. So they were like really hard pressed on my mom to not let me go back into public school because it's just not an accepting environment. Which looking back kind of defeated the purpose of me transitioning in the first place, which was to just disappear into society. But when they put the blocker in, I was having like really severe hot flashes. I was like waking up at night, like just like complete cold sweats. It was awful. I would get like pains, like in my like private area, like really severe pains that felt like someone was like stabbing me, or that my stuff was just like seizing up, like atrophying, basically was what it was doing. At a certain point, I was having like full body Charlie horses because I had like a lot of muscle atrophy that happened. I couldn't like keep weight on at all. It completely killed my appetite. And I ended up peeing blood at a certain point, and they didn't really want to acknowledge that that was something to do with the blocker implant. But if you Google hysterelin and you go on the website, one of the major side effects of it is blood in the urine. And around that time, I basically had my mom push really, really hard to get it taken out. So after a couple of years, they wanted me to have it in until I was like 18, 20. But I got it taken out at like, I was 16 going on 17 when we got it taken out.
Oh my God.
You had the implant for how long total?
So I got it put in. I think I had just turned 14. So 16, two and a half years, somewhere in that bracket.
And they wanted you on it till you were up to 20?
18 or 20. They said that they can try to stretch it, but that implant specifically went until I was 18. And if we had to replace it, we could.
So when you said earlier before we started our call that you had to stop for health reasons, this is what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Is there more kind of medical side effects that caused you and your mom to push to stop the implant?
Yeah. Well, no, the blood in the urine was kind of the icing on the cake because they never really wanted to acknowledge that that had anything to do with it. But basically, what my urologist thought it was what something in my body wasn't doing its job at clearing toxins out of like my system, like your urinary tract is supposed to do. So I was getting these really bad infections in my urethra, like, and it was causing me to like pee blood and skin, basically. And after I had the blocker taken out, that stuff cleared up within a couple of months to a year. And I no longer had issues with like urinary tract infections or blood or anything like that. I don't even get Charlie horses anymore. I was having full body like muscle spasms for a while to make it really hard for me to go to school or play sports or ride a bike because
Jesus.
my muscles would just seize up and it was so incredibly painful. And they still don't want to acknowledge that it was the blocker, but it was the only thing I was on that was different. I didn't have these issues prior to that. I had these issues on them, and then they faded within a couple of months of being off of them. You know what I mean? So it literally cannot be anything else unless it was just like some kind of freak accident that just coincidentally took place in the same bracket.
So you were getting blood in the urine, you were getting pain in your genital area, you were getting these, what you call them, Charlie horses, kind of spasm muscle cramp that were very painful. Your body was really, really rejecting it. This wasn't going well.
Yeah, literally felt like my body was breaking down. I became really susceptible to getting sick. I never really got sick much throughout my life, but while I was on the blocker, I missed so many things that I was supposed to do because a common cold just like took me off my feet.
Whoa.
I couldn't handle it. And my depression while I was on it also spiraled way out of control. I just felt absolutely drained all of the time. It was like a cloud just went over my whole world while I was on it.
And did you say you were given estrogen as well?
Yeah, I was taking estrogen in that time period so that I would have like a puberty, because they were like, you need to go through one puberty. So I op had opted for
Because
female puberty.
over where I live in Ireland and in Europe, no child is getting cross-sex hormones, like it's until they're 18, like or maybe 17 or 16, but definitely not 13 or 14.
Yeah, I've been on them since I was 13. The estrogen.
So when you came off the puberty blocker, you remained on the estrogen?
Yeah, because at that time period, I mean, I never really like explored what my dysphoria was. I definitely have an uncomfortability with my body, and it's definitely a, dysphoria means to bear, so it's definitely like a burden to bear. So when I went off the blocker, I was just like, the blocker made me sick, and it still felt like it was the right decision for me. You know what I mean? Because, I am a pretty effeminate personality, and I could not imagine, what my life would have looked like if I ended up looking like my dad or my brother. No offense to them. They're perfectly good looking guys, but just not, it's just something that I didn't think that like. And you can tell I still kind of struggle with the idea, because I'm just coming to an age where I'm really able to like explore a lot of these emotions with like my adult faculties and kind of like strip them down. But at that period, I couldn't really strip it down any further than I just have a dysphoria. I just have a problem with my body,
Well, when I say that, I'm not implying that you should have gotten off. I'm just trying to understand almost from like a, because we're like discovering this medical experiment, and I'm just trying to piece together as a ch you're a child, you're 16 at that point. The blocker was very obviously the culprit of why you were sick. So you come off the blocker. But at this point, your body is going to be producing testosterone and you're getting estrogen, right? I just want to make sure medically I
Yes.
understand. So then what
Yes.
was that like, I guess, from a physiological perspective, psychologically, did your depression lift? Like how did that go when you were off the blocker but on estrogen?
So technically, they had assigned me like a lower level of Spiro to go back onto, but I wasn't really taking it all the time because I was like obviously very put off by it. So I've been pretty much on like, I guess I would take like a Spiro pill, like maybe I would half it. So I would take maybe like the halves of, I was supposed to take one pill a day, and I would take the halves like maybe like twice a week kind of
Is that
stuff.
because you intuitively thought this is bad and I'm resisting it, or what was it?
Well, I've always been pretty sensitive to like, what, I don't know, it just felt, I just had a bad taste in
Well,
my
because
mouth
it's a
from my past
blocker.
experiences.
Spiro is a blocker. So was that you're like, well, blockers don't work well for me, kind of
Well,
thing.
after I had found out how Spiro like impacts your organs and stuff, I was pretty like put off by it, obviously. So I was trying to avoid taking that, but I was taking estrogen. So I'd have like hot flashes, and my emotions sometimes go up and down, but like not in like ridiculous, like I'm not just crying for no reason, you know what I mean? But like, I don't know, it just, I also get these like real bad pains in my chest, like really bad pains. Like sometimes, like when I was working in a kitchen, I would have to take breaks because my breasts also feel like they seize up kind of like that. And it just, it's caused me so many issues, but that got a lot more prominent when I went off of a blocker.
And did the estrogen, when you started taking it at 13, did you then grow breasts?
Oh yeah, I have like fully female typical like breasts.
What was that like? I mean, I know that the way the doctors, gender medicine doctors, treat it as though you have this choice of what puberty you'd like to go to. Like, and you even said, I chose the female puberty, and it's no
Yeah,
fault of your own at all. That's how it's framed to you as a kid.
it was very like, I don't know, like commercialized, Americanized, like marketed kind of
Yeah.
thing.
Yeah,
Even though I
you're
had like,
buying, yeah,
yeah, even though
consumer.
insurance covered, you know, most of my stuff, not all of it, but most of it. Like, I don't know, as to what it was like to like grow female typical breasts, I never really thought anything of it because I was just like, I was just going through puberty for me, you know, I was already kind of a, you know, feminine kid. So it wasn't really hard for me to like make that adjustment. It wasn't really until I was like, oh, sorry, I almost dropped you. It wasn't until I like got out into the world and like was trying to like date and stuff that it like kind of, you know, became apparent to me like, oh, my body type is pretty unusual because when I had first, you know, was going on this stuff, part of the questions I would have for my doctor, because he was also LGBT, I won't like comment on, you know, what part, but that was part of their identity as well.
But wait, your doctor was your doctor trans?
No.
Okay.
No,
Okay,
just a
carry on.
different sexual identity. And or romantic identity. And it, so I would be like, you know, what's my dating life gonna be like, basically? And it almost was like implied that my dating pool would be wider if I transitioned, because then, you know, straight, I would be in the dating pool of like straight men, basically, because there's much less gay guys and there's more straight guys, was like a mindset behind that.
Wow.
So when I got out into the world and I was like, oh, you know, my body type is pretty unusual. You know, the only men that are really into me are generally like older men that have already like developed, like, you know, like they're looking for something unusual. You know what I mean? It's never been like people my own age that like want to just like get to know me because, you know, I have a really unusual body type. And, you know, I didn't really understand that until I got out into the world. But until then, like, it was just normal to me. I never really thought anything of having my breasts other than they hurt really bad sometimes. It just never.
I remember when I was younger, like we're talking in the 90s, and there was always a certain man who went over to Thailand and was into that. You know what I mean? It was quite well known that there was a certain man, but it's a quite a sexualized existence.
Yeah, and I didn't really understand that at the time because, you know, I was young, so I was thinking like, oh, Prince Charming. I wasn't
Oh.
thinking like, you know, this like guy that left his wife and now wants something different, you know, because that's the majority of like what is out there for
Totally.
people like me. And I don't want to say that's the case for everybody because, like, you know, I've known transsexuals that have, you know, fallen in love and have had perfectly fine relationships, but it's definitely in the minority, unfortunately. And I don't think that that's because of the culture or anything. I just think that it's that way because, you know, transsexuals or people with my body type are just not very common. So people that are, you know, drawn to that just aren't very common. And I didn't really, you know, understand that until I was out there in the dating world. And that's kind of like what made me start thinking about how unusual my situation really was, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And the estrogen, it gave you breasts. Did it give you hips? Did it give you a female body shape?
Yeah, I have pretty prominent hips. A lot of people comment on the way I walk because I guess I like walk like people say I strut, but I'm not like trying to. I'm just like walking. I guess my female typical hips have made it a little bit more like obvious, but yeah. So I have female typical hips. Like my bones are a little bit more placed outward. And I don't really know how I feel about that. I don't really ever think about it, honestly. Doesn't really ever come up for me. The breasts have become more of a problem, especially like now that a couple years have gone by, because I have a little lump in one of them. And I've not been able to really get, like, I just found a doctor that was willing to take a look at it. So I had to set up like another scan and everything for later this year. But for a long time, I haven't really gotten anybody to look at it. They were just kind of like dismissed, like the pain in my breasts and stuff is like, oh, they're growing. Or if like I would have like a little bit of like stuff that would like come out of them, they'd be like, oh, you're just like lactating. And it's like, but that doesn't really make any sense because a I'm a male and B, I'm not like pregnant.
Breastfeeding.
Yeah.
And
that always stood out as kind of unusual to me, but that's what the doctors were telling me. And not just the doctors that were prescribing me stuff, like multiple doctors that my mom has taken me to over the years have just told us that, no, my boobs are just growing and I just lactate sometimes. Like that's a normal thing. And wow. It's very much like it's very much caused me issues with like the clothes that I can wear and stuff like that because
My God.
This isn't a minor issue. This is like a daily, you have to accommodate daily to this medical challenge.
Very much so. I've had to like be mindful about the things that I wear and the settings that like, you know, because some settings I can be more comfortable in and, you know, but yeah, it's affected my jobs. Like I said, I lost a job over some of these issues, like with the pain. I couldn't really like lift heavy things because it's a lot of stress is put on that like little knot. It hurts really, really bad. And yeah, it's just like a whole thing.
A little knot in your breast.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Are you still on estrogen right now?
No, I've been off of it for maybe like 6-7 months. I was taking it like not regularly for a while because I was kind of wanted to wean myself off of it and see if like I actually would masculinize as much as people had implied. And so far that has not been the case. Like I think my brow grew a little bit and I get like little like whiskers, blonde whiskers here, but I just like pluck those and it's like not been a problem.
So you never went through any male puberty?
Not really. I mean, I have an Adam's apple and I have a strong jawline a little bit and my nose kind of grew a little bit, but that's pretty much it.
Can you catch us up to that point when you 6 or 7 months ago, when you stopped taking estrogens, like you described all the medical complications that you've had, but ostensibly you were still going to doctors. You're like asking about these things and you're not getting satisfactory answers. At what point did you start to, I mean, also I'd love to hear like how you kind of think about all of this now and how you think about yourself now, but like,
In order to do that, I have to go back to when I was 17. I called my original doctor and, you know, was like, you know, you like basically asking him about some of this, like, you know, you said this wouldn't happen in regards to like my sexual dysfunction and stuff like that, because that really bothered me as a teenager. And basically the conversation didn't go well and I never ended up speaking to him again after that. There was no like communication. He had sent me a reference to another doctor in a city that I cannot get to because I could not at the time and still cannot drive. So it was just like a whole shebang. And my mom had to help me find another doctor that actually turned out to be closer and much more honest with me about the side effects of this stuff. But there is a little couple year period there where I wasn't really like directly seeing a doctor. I was just kind of like my prescriptions were still there, but there wasn't really any like regular visits. And then I found this other doctor who was just like straight up open with all of this. Like I would ask her a question about the sexual dysfunction. She'd be like, yep, also this, 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 and this. And it overwhelmed me the first couple of times. Like I would cry and they would have to like give me a minute because I was just overwhelmed by the sheer honesty, but also like kind of like taken aback by the pure like scientific like tone of it all. Just her honesty basically filled in, you know, the input that I wanted to know since the beginning. And I was like, well, you know, maybe maybe it would be okay for me to try to like just give it up to Mother Nature for a while and just like instead of constantly fighting, like I felt like I've had to be doing, maybe I just need to try surrendering for once and just like kind of lean into like, and this is gonna sound so stupid because we live in an age of like technology and people like all people think that medicine improves everything, but sometimes it's best to just like relax and let nature do its thing. You know what I mean? Because like our bodies are ecosystems like unto themselves. So I'm just like, I just made a decision to just kind of surrender it to like Mother Nature for a minute and just like see, you know, what happens, at least until I can get this lump checked out, because I didn't want to stay on estrogen while I had a bump in my breast. You know, just in case. Not saying that it is anything, but on the off chance that it is, I don't want to be like potentially like feeding it those synthetic hormones. Does that make
What
sense?
it does make sense, but what's so enraging on your behalf is how, since the age of 13, there isn't a feeling of a doctor looking after you. There isn't a feeling, informed consent isn't even in the room here. This is you raising issues and being told not to worry, and basically stop asking questions was really the attitude. And your mother was shimmied out of the room. It just feels like the most awful, awful care that you were given.
It's definitely not what I thought I would be getting when I went on this route. You know, we didn't really have the words for exploratory therapy back then, but I thought like, oh, I'm gonna get in contact with, you know, this, you know, LGBT friendly place, and they're gonna put me in contact with, you know, elders of like, you know, people like me, and I was gonna be able to like have a little bit of self-discovery and like learn to be more comfortable with myself before going on like such a major route. I thought that I would like be led to more of an understanding, because at that point, you know, I was young, so I was kind of like looking to like people around me a little bit more to like understand my emotions and why I had so many problems with myself. Now that I'm older and I have more like adult faculties, it's much more easy for me to just like look within. But I didn't really have that capability at that time. So I was just kind of looking for like therapy from these professionals to kind of like, I don't know, just figure out like why I felt this way and why everything about myself felt so bad, if that
Oh,
makes sense.
God.
You know, Scarlett, when I listen to everything you've shared, from the minute you had your first appointment with the gender therapist to the doctors and endocrinologists, this is like fantasy care. Everybody was living in a fantasy. They were selling you a fantasy. Oh, that's something sparked an idea.
So, yeah, you saying fantasy sparked a memory. So when before, so way back, I'm sorry to jump around like this. It's just
Please.
like a lot, and
I know, it's okay.
I'm like having memories as we're like talking about it.
Oh.
So after my first appointment with the gender therapist, they wanted my mom to get me like synthetic like breasts and stuff to like see if it was like the right path for me. I remember them sending me to a specific place called Janet's Closet, which is like, you know, a business that exists for reasons. I don't want to condemn them, but it's like a transvestite store. It's like a fetish shop, for transvestites. And I remember my mom
Oh
being
my
sh-
God.
'cause we didn't know what it was. But they wanted to like, this was like their way to make sure that like it was like the right path for me. And I remember the owner stopping us at the door and my mom having to show them her transvestite, the owner of the store.
Yeah, yeah.
She had to show them a certificate from the hospital that like I was assigned to be there. So this person had to like walk us like past, like trying to evade all of the fetish gear. And it was some pretty horrific stuff that I
Oh my
saw.
God.
And I just remember my mom being like absolutely devastated through all of this. Like, I don't know. I didn't really like understand at the time how fucked up it was, but like
Jesus.
years down the line, I'm like, you know, that's a pretty like messed up memory. And I never even really wore the synthetic thing, so that was like useless because it wasn't like I wasn't otogynephilic, so I didn't like want to wear fake breasts and stuff like that. That just felt weird to me. But that was like what the doctor said I needed because they needed to know if like I liked looking at myself like that. You know what I mean? It was just weird stuff.
Jesus. Did they talk much like as I you know the puberty blockers would have stopped your sexual development, your genital growth. Did they talk much about genital surgery or vaginoplasty or anything?
So the thought process was that we were just gonna head in that route. My mom was not down for that. Like she was okay with like, you know, me socially transitioning. And then they kind of like stepped in and like not threatened her, but like kind of implied it with, you know, me being a ward of the state and everything with the hormones and all of that. But she was not okay with me getting surgery. And I remember a couple of surgeons writing to us and stuff, like from the hospital trying to link us up. And they were like they were getting letters from psychiatrists that like I'd never like really had a consultation with. And they were just like totally down. Like they wanted me to get an orchiectomy at one point, which is where they like remove your testicles and stuff.
This
Because then
place
I
should
wouldn't
be
have to be
shut
on a
down.
blocker. Yeah. It was a lot. And it wasn't ever something that like I was really like going for. Like I wasn't a big fan of what I have because I, you know, was sexualized young and stuff like that. So obviously that creates some issues. And I've had unfortunate incidences like, you know, since growing up and stuff. So, but I never wanted to get like surgery for it. You know what I mean? That just never really felt right. I never felt like the science was quite there, nor did it feel like something that I felt like would fix whatever I was dealing with. But it was definitely like implied and definitely pushed a couple of times. My mom and I had to be pretty vehemently opposed to it more than once. And I have a couple of friends that actually got the surgery. That we were the same age and it didn't end up going well. Like there was that same neglect.
Oh my God. From the same hospital, you have other friends who did get the surgery.
Started at the same hospital. They ended up, you know, all of my friends, none of them have gotten surgery in the United States. They've all been in other countries, like, you know, over in Asia. Some of them have been in Canada. One of them flew down to Mexico, type of stuff.
Wow. I imagine that we're going to have to start bringing this conversation to a close. Though I think I could talk to you for a long, long, long time. I want to ask what has it been like in the last several months, as you described, letting nature take its course? How have you felt? Has it been worse, better, the same? Are there things that are surprising you, things that are just what can you share with us about that? I know it's very personal, so just whatever you're comfortable with.
I mean, all of the above. It's been really hard on my professional life, just because like the public doesn't really know how to react with me. People don't know what to call me with my pronouns, and it makes a lot of people really uncomfortable. And I work in sales, so if people are uncomfortable with me and they don't
Oh,
really want
yeah.
to say it, that makes it really hard to sometimes do my job. And I try not to let it get to me. I practice open presence a lot, so I try to just let it go with my breath. But it does make things really hard a lot. It makes it hard to relate to people sometimes just because my life has been so radically, you know, not in the norm that like there's just a lot of very basic normal life experiences that I don't really like relate to because I was, you know, isolated and going through a transition. You know, and my autism probably plays into that somewhat too. I already have somewhat of a hard time relating to people, in that regard. But in my personal life, it's been I don't know. I feel like I'm, it's felt like a deepening of my awareness in my own skin. Not really for positive or negative. I'm just learning to like not really label my emotions as they come up. It's just like it is, and that is it kind of thing. And I try to practice that quite a bit, and it's helped me a lot in like understanding like the deeper layers of like my dysphoria just a little bit. I'm still exploring it. I'm doing a lot of shadow work in regards to that. But it's allowed me to kind of see the base of it being, you know, shame and the guilt associated with things I went through as a child and a lot of the homophobia I faced. I'm trying not to label it as like for positive or for negative. It just, you know, when those feelings arise, it's just like, okay, there it is. And, you know, it passes and it arises and it passes. So I'm learning to develop like a flow in my personal life. I'm just trying to figure out how to bleed that into work because society is so focused on this stuff right now. So it makes it a little difficult.
Could I ask you before we move into the exclusive content, what is your position? When did you change pronouns and when did you change name? And what is your position now around pronouns and name?
So I changed my name. Well, I changed my pronouns like almost immediately. I always kind of felt uncomfortable with my social role as like a male. So that was a pretty like easy thing. And
Was
you know,
this like
RuPaul's,
13 or something like that? Or,
yeah. And like, you know, on RuPaul's Drag Race, you know, drag queens are called she and stuff, you know, even out of drag. So that was pretty like normal for me. And that's kind of how I view it. Like if people call me sir at work all the time and I'm never like, oh my God, how dare you? It's like, you know, it just it, there it is, and that's it. You know, it happens and it's gone, and there's not really anything else to that. But most people that know me personally call me she. And I started going by Scarlett when I was like 14. And I mean, it's fine. I don't really have any feelings about it. I just kind of like adapted to it, and that's just like what most people call me. And it doesn't really arouse like any like conflict or emotion. I don't feel now where I am as adverse to my birth name. I just think it's an unattractive name, and it's just not, but it's not like any like, it doesn't evoke any like catastrophic dysphoric emotions or anything because it's just a name. Yeah, that's kind of where I stand on that now.
Before we wrap up this portion of the conversation, we had been connected before, and you had reached out to me and Stella to say, I'd like to share my story. Is there anything that you haven't been able to say yet that feels important for you?
Oh, not that I can think of. Well, one thing, because I did do a live stream with another creator in the past, and I kind of got my timeline mixed up a little bit just because it's so much to remember all at once.
And you were
And
a kid.
I had just turned 18, but this person I think was being very compassionate. It was done out of the goodness of their heart, but it just wasn't the therapeutic setting that I needed to really kind of like go through it chronologically. So I got very convoluted. And some people were calling into question like my history, basically. So I just kind of wanted to put that out there. Like when you've dealt with a lot of trauma like this and you have to go through your whole life, it can be very hard to like pay attention to everyone else's reactions and try to like focus on other people while trying to remember all of that. But that aside, I feel like I've gotten everything out and gone all over everything. So thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're
We'd
so
like to move into the extra section and maybe ask about what you needed, what you think you might have needed when you were younger and now, like what were the things that actually could have helped you?
Yeah, so maybe for here, we'll kind of say goodbye and then we'll take that question into the next section. Is that okay? All
Yeah.
right. Well,
Thank
thank you
you.
for joining us.
Yeah, of course. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us this week on Gender, a Wider Lens.
If you enjoyed the show, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify.
And be sure to visit us on Substack by going to widerlenspod.com. There you can join our listener community, access bonus content and resources, plus learn about additional ways to support the show.
Our discussions are for educational purposes and are not intended as a substitute for mental health services.